Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the weekly podcast for people who play with needles.
Yes. And it's a good thing that we're not in proximity today because we'd probably be stabbing each other with those needles.
there is potential.
Yes, just as background, so all of you don't know us very well because we've only been doing this particular podcast for a very short period of time, but Gary and I have been doing podcasts in general for, my goodness, now what's almost 6-7 years now.
Yep.
So, and we don't live in the same state, and I think we see each other probably once a year in person, but we've developed this rapport of, I guess publicly we're quite friendly, aren't we? But between ourselves, it's almost like that sibling want to jab each other in the face sometimes. So, so we were just teasing each other before we started recording about the differences between people who live on the coasts of America versus people who live in the middle of America. So you all just caught that tail end of that. So back to playing with needles.
Yes. Proceed. And speaking of living on the coast, our guest this week is Yvette.
Yeah.
Yvette, I've been corrected on how to say this. Yvette Stanton from Sydney,
correct.
Australia. Yes, Yvette. Now, see, I can't
Hello.
Help it now. Hi. Yvette, I have to practice now, see?
You're doing well.
Okay. Yves Saint Laurent and Yvette, okay.
That's correct.
Okay, so Yvette, for those who don't know, Yvette is probably the most visible person in the white work embroidery end of this hobby that there is, I would guess. First one I encountered, and I followed you for some time now.
Oh, that's very nice.
Well, you know, my thing is I've done just enough Hardanger to get over the fear of cutting the ground cloth.
Oh, that's good.
So I'm comfortable with that. It doesn't bother me to cut. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's a big hurdle because that's not normal.
It is.
So then in doing research, that's where I encountered you. And, so then I followed you ever since. And eight books.
That's right.
Left-handed and right-handed embroiderer's companion. Got to ask you about that because I'm left-handed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So am I.
Oh, okay. So that's, all right. Well, all right. We're going to explore that then. Sardinian knotted embroidery, white work from where?
Tayulada. It's in Sardinia.
Tayulada.
It's a little town, Tayulada. Hmm. So it's on the sort of on the southern coast of Sardinia, which is off the coast of Italy. And it's not Scandinavia. A lot of people say to me, oh, Scandinavian embroidery. No. Sardinian embroidery. Quite different.
Yeah, it's a long way from Scandinavia.
That's right.
And then Portuguese white work, bullion embroidery from where do you find these places?
Oh, well, I'm always looking out for interesting forms of white work. So I go to some pretty strange places. Well, they're not strange places. They're just far-flung.
Say that name again.
Guimarães.
Okay, where's that at? This is what we call world geography right here with Yvette.
White work geography. In Portugal, it's in the north of Portugal. If you know where Porto is on the coast, it's inland from there.
Okay. All right. And then elegant Hardanger embroidery. Then Mount Melick. Pardon me?
That's right. I was going to say, I think you know where Hardanger embroidery is from.
Yes. That I got. I got that. And then Mount Melick embroidery, inspired by nature. So where or what is Mount Melick?
Okay, so Mount Melick is a little town in the middle of Ireland. If you know where Dublin is on the coast, if you head about halfway across the country towards the west, it's in the middle there. It's in a little county called Laois, and there isn't very much there. When we went and visited there, there was a ploughing competition on at the same time. So it gives you an idea of the sort of countryside you're in.
Okay. All right. We're going to have fun with these. I can tell right now. then Ukrainian drawn thread embroidery. And then it's...
That's right.
What
Mareshka, Mareshka Poltavska. So Mareshka is a Russian word for cut work. And Poltavska means it comes from Poltava in Ukraine.
I'm humbled here. And then your newest book, just out months ago, is Early Style Hardanger. And that's when you went back to the Hardanger Fjord area and went back to the origins of that stitching. Yes. That's a fascinating story to me.
Something that I'd been wanting to do for many years, and the opportunity came up, so it was the right time.
Yeah. Okay, we got to get to those, but okay, let's get people oriented. How'd you get started? How do you get yourself to be so knowledgeable about white work? I mean, did you start out doing basic cross stitch? What'd you do?
I started off, I was always a very creative child, so I actually have a twin sister, and me and my twin sister Prue, we used to do a lot of craft when we were little, and we were always encouraged by our parents to do that. When I was, I can't really remember the age, but it was probably around 9 or 10, my parents gave me a copy of the Reader's Digest Complete Guide to Needlecraft. And I used to just work my way through that in the school holidays and at weekends. So people used to talk about being bored in the school holidays. Well, that was a foreign concept to me. I always had something to do.
Working your way through that book, huh?
That's right. So it had some embroidery in it. It had crocheting. It had knitting. There was quilting and patchwork as well. So I just, you know, experimented with all of it and loved doing that sort of thing. And then when I was at high school, I took textiles and design and really loved that. And that was where I first came across Hardanger embroidery. I was taught that in year 10 at school.
In school you were taught that?
I was, yeah. We had an amazing textiles department at our school, and the teachers really knew their stuff. So I consider myself to be so very fortunate that I was taught that way back then.
But then by then you had an incredible base of knowledge about stitching and needlework then.
Oh, I wouldn't have said really. I just was very creative and was willing always to try something new.
There you go. That's the refrain, right? You can't be afraid to fail.
Yeah. And if you do fail, well, you try again.
That's right.
Yep. Okay, so you get that class in 10th grade in school, year 10 in school. Then do you keep it up?
Yeah, I did. I kept embroidering. I didn't actually study textiles and design for my final 2 years of schooling, which in New South Wales, which is the state that I'm in, you do the higher school certificate. So I didn't study it for that, but I did art instead. So I still kept my creativity up. And then after school, I went to university and did graphic design, and I continued stitching all the time while I was at uni. And that was what I did to relax.
See, I wish I'd have had that. Of course, I'd have been laughed right out of the dorm. But, you know, it would have been a nice diversion. You know, but yeah, I mean, I'd have never survived in a, because it was all men's dorm, so I'd have never survived. Sure. So when you're studying, to be able to just stop and go do something like that would be really relaxing. And
yeah, not that my course was terribly mentally demanding anyway. It was very creatively demanding because it was graphic design, so most of the work that we did was very practical anyway.
Oh, okay.
So you took a break from art by doing art.
Well, yeah, of course.
But it was art by choice, and then it becomes right that it's different.
That's right. Yes, these weren't assignments that I was getting done. This was just something for personal satisfaction.
All the difference, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then what do you do with your graphic art degree?
I went to work as a book designer for a publishing company, which was actually Reader's Digest. So they started me off on my needlework, and then I continued working for them later on. And so I worked in the general books department, not the condensed books. And we used to do lots of big books that would take us about a year to get through each one. And yeah, I had a wonderful time doing that.
What fun. Because I'm a magazine editor, so I relate to it. Yeah.
Yep.
Words on paper, it's fun. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you're designing books and you're still stitching. At some point, you must start designing and start thinking about breaking off and doing this needlework thing on your own.
Well, I probably always pretty much designed my own embroideries. I mean, there were a few cross stitches that I did when I was little that were given to me that I stitched. But when I was doing Hardanger, apart from I think the first one that I ever did, they were, I think, all designed by me. And so while I was working as a book designer, I would continue doing Hardanger and decided that I'd like to enter the Nordic Needle Hardanger competition. So I did that and I thought, well, if I'm going to do this all the way from Australia, it's got to be good. So I made sure it was fantastic and I did end up being one of the winners that year. So that was really lovely. And that's where the whole needlework career started.
So your first year of competition, you enter an international competition and you're one of the winners.
Yeah, well, I had to make sure it was going to be good. I had to send it all the way from Australia, so I wanted to be in with a good chance.
Of course, but that's just flat out impressive.
Oh, well, wow. Thank you.
Wow. Yeah. So did you get to travel to Scandinavia to get your award? Or I have no idea where the award was, but
Nordic Needle is in the U.S.
Oh.
It's a Hardanger shop, basically. Well, they do a lot of...
Oh, that shop. I know that shop.
Yeah, Nordic Needle. Yeah.
Oh. I had visions of this Nordic international competition in Sweden or something. Oh, see, I was...
No. It is an international competition, but it is in America.
Okay. I know that shop. Yes. Okay. I had you way up on this really lofty pedal. Now I got to put you in pretty high.
Sorry about that.
It's quite all right. It was fun.
So for the uninitiated of us, can you describe how this type of embroidery is different and more enjoyable or less enjoyable than other types?
Okay,
so tell me how I would recognize it.
Right. It's traditionally worked in white on white. It's a counted embroidery like cross stitch is. So you place your stitches according to where the threads of the fabric are. Unlike, say, crewel embroidery, where you can put your stitches pretty much anywhere you want on the surface of the fabric, Hardanger, it's worked from a chart or a graph, and you place your stitches according to counting the threads. There are some surface stitches, such as satin stitch, and there's quite a few pulled thread stitches, such as cable stitch and eyelets. And then once you've done all of them, then comes the slightly scary bit. I don't find it scary, and a lot of other people don't either, where you cut the threads, some of them, and remove some of them. And then in the spaces, you work some needle weaving back onto some the threads that are left and create lacy effects.
Yeah, that's the fun part.
Yeah.
Be careful where you cut.
Definitely.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I'd done just enough of it to at least be over that hump. And and once you do it once successfully, then you realize if you just pay attention to where you put the scissors, it's really not a big deal.
Well, yes, and you need to be careful that you're concentrating when you do your cutting. I wouldn't do it at the end of a day where you've had a bad day. I would make sure you're fresh and you're concentrating well and you can see really well as well.
That's a good point too.
Yeah, I agree. I've made that mistake. And
oh, I think we all have.
Yeah, just a little bit I've done. Yeah, oops.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Is it repairable? If you cut the wrong thing, it's kind of shot, isn't it? Or
yeah, no, it depends. Sometimes it's going to be too far gone, but other times you can replace a thread that's been cut in error. So all is generally not lost. And that's why making a mistake in a class is a great thing to do, because your teacher can show you how to fix it.
There we go. Yeah. Well, then once, you know, what little I've done, and of course, looking at your designs, you know, once you're able to cut that thread and open up those holes, what you can do in those spaces is so much fun.
Oh, it is. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it really.
And that's what they were trying to create, lace, when they started making this embroidery. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you're doing when you're weaving these threads back in. You're making lace.
So you learned how to, you taught yourself how to do it.
No, I was taught at school.
That's right. You were at your school, and then you just refined that, and then Now, I don't want to get into the books yet. Because I want to explore each of the books and each of the different types. For you, Hardanger, is that the primary thing you do in your stitching? Just as an ongoing thing?
I generally tend to be stitching whatever I'm working on for my next book. But Hardanger, I would say, is my first love.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so fun to see your things because, I mean, you do the aprons and the collars and that collar mm-hmm. that you have in your newest book, is just beautiful. When those collars are done, they're done as a separate thing and then attached
they
to
are,
a,
yes.
a blouse.
Yes. Yeah, they are. And on the traditional blouses, they have it on the cuffs as well, on the sleeves, and they also would have a panel down over the chest area too.
Mm.
Oh, okay. So is that applied to the top of a blouse or over?
They would make the blouse with those pieces as part of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Same with the collars and the cuffs then.
That's right, yep.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if that was an add-on thing or just how that went.
It's constructed into it.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let's just talk about the books because I'm just dying to learn about all these things. So your first two books, Left-Handed, we'll just go in order here. Left-Handed Embroidered.
No, they're not the first ones. The first book that I wrote was Elegant Hardanger Embroidery.
Really? Oh.
It was, yeah. And that came about because I entered the Nordic Needle competition and was a winner. And so I thought, right, well, I'd really like to do some, I'd like to contribute to some books perhaps that are already happening. So I wrote to some publishers, Australian publishers of needlework books and said, look, I've just won this award. Would you be interested in me contributing to any books that you already have going? And two of them got back to me and said, we'd like you to write a book for us. And I went, Oh, I hadn't thought
that.
Oops.
That all the worst.
And so I did. That's how I wrote the first one, and that was Elegant Hardanger Embroidery.
Wow. I bet you didn't expect that.
No, I didn't at all.
Now what have I gotten myself into?
Well, I loved the process, though, because I've always been a reader. I've always loved words. And so, you know, to put that together with my graphic design skills, working as a book designer, and also with my embroidery skills, it was the perfect thing to do.
Yeah. Now, is that book primarily projects, or is it how is that put together?
Okay, so all of my historical white work books are teaching how to do the embroidery and some projects as well. So I'll teach you how to do it, and then I'll give you something to try that out on.
And then now, like your what little I tried really hard to get after we set this up to get your newest book, but I couldn't get it here fast enough.
So, sure.
but from what I've read in that primarily Mary Corbett's review of it, you put mm-hmm. in quite a bit of history of.
Well, I like to, yeah, because when I explore a form of historical needlework, I want to present it in a way that makes the original custodians of that embroidery proud. And so their cultural and historical information that goes with that is really important to that. And that's why when I do a book, I generally like to go and visit the place that it's from so I can meet the people and see the work in its context. And I just really think that that helps.
Yeah, I think it makes it easier to understand as well and easier yep. to do because if you understand the purpose of the work to begin with, like, so for example, talking about this type of embroidery being used for cuffs and collars and yes. decorative elements of blouses, then you start thinking, okay, well, all right, so this is the purpose that it's going to serve. This is the sort of degree of sturdiness that this piece needs to have. It sort of gives yep. you a feel for what it is that you're going to be trying to achieve aside from just yeah. something, you know, pretty that, you know, takes up some time. So
yeah,
I think that's, it's not only just interesting from a historical perspective, it also helps you, really get a sort of a visceral feel of what it is that you are going to be making and why certain elements of it are important to do the way that they are, because
that's
it serves a function
true.
In their
yes.
initial, you know, in sort of in the initial way it was used, right?
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I had so much fun when your latest book, Early Style Hardinger, following your blog as you were researching what you know, as much as you were sharing, because I understandably you were being secretive because you didn't want to.
Try not to be too annoying with that, though.
Well, no, I mean it was understandable. I mean, but still, there was some education going on. So you traveled to the Hardinger Fjord area to do that book.
Yes.
Did you travel for the first book or?
I didn't, not for that one, no. At the time I was writing the first book, I was actually on maternity leave with my first child, so it really was a bit out of the question.
I thought it was because the prize from Nordic Needle wasn't big enough.
Oh, well, there could be that.
But so then
no,
to do this.
I had a young baby.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's legitimate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then to do this newest book then, but you got the, it sounded like just a fantastic thrill to be able to go over there and explore the very roots of the techniques.
Oh, it was wonderful. And it was all organized within about 2 weeks. There was just this opportunity that came up and I just thought, right, this is the book to do. Now is the time to do it. It came about that it was in about 2 weeks until Norwegian Constitution Day, the 17th of May. That's their big day in Norway where everyone comes out dressed in their traditional costumes and they parade in the streets. And so I thought if I can possibly be there for when that is on and also do the research at the same time, that would be fantastic. So I got in contact with Agnete Sivertsen, who is the curator at the Hardanger Folk Museum in Utna, which is on the, well, basically right on the edge of the Hardanger Fjord, which is actually said Hardanger Fjord in Norway. And she was very happy for me to come and spend some time with me. And we looked at the embroidery and I asked her so many questions and it was just fantastic. And so actually for Norwegian Constitution Day, I was in Bergen, which is on the west coast, which is the largest town nearby the Hardanger Fjord. And so I got to see their parade there. And they have one of the best parades in Norway. So it was just wonderful.
Mm, what a treat.
Yeah.
What a treat. Yeah. And so, yeah, so then you got to see native, I don't know if that's the right word, but the costumes were original stuff where you're seeing the very origins of the stitching. I'm fascinated by, because it's a stitching style and technique that is isolated to a very relatively small region, right? How is it that happens and that it pretty much stays there?
Well, it started in around the early 1700s. And so if you consider the countryside in that area, it's very mountainous and there's fjords. So travel would have been limited and much of the year it's snow country. So geographically they would have been very isolated for much of the year. There would have been trade because, you know, Norwegians are great traders. But I think it's just because of the geography of the area, that's how it came to be such a distinct style from a region.
Okay, just sheer isolation then.
Yeah, yeah.
And from what I've read, what little I've been able to put together here, there's a distinct difference between the Hardinger that we tend to do today and this early style, the original style. What are some of the differences?
Yes. Okay, the main difference is the scale. So a lot of Hardanger these days is done on, say, about 22-count linen. I never worked mine that large, but they would have worked theirs in Hardanger back in those times on between 35 and 55-count linen.
Holy smokes.
So, yeah, wow. Exactly. I've done a little bit of work on 50-count linen, and my goodness, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and they back then they didn't have the lighting or certainly not magnifiers. Wow.
No, that's right. And, you know, life in that area, there's a lot of orchards. So they did farming of stone fruit and that sort of thing. So they would have been out in their fields in the daytime doing this hard work in the summertime. And then in the wintertime, you think, well, maybe that's when they did all their embroidery. But it would have been dark so much of the year and so much of the day. I don't know when they did it, how they did it. I have no idea.
And on that fine a cloth too. Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
So that part I did not realize. So that's why your designs are so beautiful, but that certainly helps to be on that fine cloth.
It does.
Yeah.
And what they were trying to do was create lace. So they were seeing the needle-made lace that was coming from Europe from the 1600s. There was a lot of that sort of thing in Italy, so reticella, that sort of work. And they were seeing that and thinking, let's make our own. And that's how this came about. They were creating lace.
Oh, now, see, I got to go back and try because all I've ever done is on 22 count.
Well, you've got a whole new world ahead of you.
Yeah. Well, see, I never had thought about finer count. I thought that was just the standard cloth. And
no, well, see, people talk about hardanger cloth, and they think that that was traditionally used. They never used anything like that. So hardanger cloth has two threads that are parallel to each other that go over in pairs and under and over in the weave. Well, they only ever used a single weave cloth in Norway. The whole idea of hardanger cloth, I think it came from a manufacturer who had this cloth to sell and said, all right, why don't we put hardanger on this? So I think that is it's a very misleading thing for a lot of people.
I've learned something here because, I mean, I thought that was the standard cloth. That's what you used.
No, not at all.
Oh.
And the other thing there are many things that are different about the traditional work, but they also use linen thread on the linen fabric rather than the pearl cotton that we would use today. So linen thread, it doesn't have as much shine generally, though I did see some pieces in the Folk Museum at Utna that were as shiny as a rayon would be. So they had obviously been pressed so many times and basically burnished that they had a beautiful shine to them. One of the other advantages of using linen thread is when you're working pulled thread, when you pull your linen thread and, say, pinch it between your finger and thumb when you're pulling your stitch, because it's linen, it creases and it stays exactly where you want it to, whereas other threads would relax back again. It doesn't. So it's got a huge advantage in that too.
Well, my mind is reeling here. There's literally a whole different world than I've experienced.
Yeah, it is. And that's why I wanted to introduce this style of embroidery to people, because it is so different to what people think of as hardanger. So I think it's in the introduction of the book, I say something like, whatever you know about hardanger, forget it, because this is quite different.
Hmm. So now I understand why that stuff is so delicate and beautiful, because because what I've been doing is, in relative terms, rather clunky.
I'm sure it was beautiful in its own way.
No, but I mean, it's, you know, when I look at your designs and the pictures and I look at the stuff I've done, it's rather clunky. And yet, I mean, I like it. I'm happy with it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I think, wow, it's not the same quality, if that's the right word. And now I know why, because it's a whole different world. Yeah.
It is. Yes, it is.
So when you stitch now, do you use linen thread or do you use pearl?
I use linen thread. Yep. If I'm doing something that I want to be in the traditional style, then yes, I use linen thread.
Wow, that's fun. That's fun. So your newest book then is how many projects?
Off the top of my head, I think it's 10.
10? Okay. And I got to get you to say this because I've been corrected on all my things so far tonight. So it's that one, is it Biscornu? How do we say that?
Yeah, well done. Yeah,
well,
that's how
you.
I would say it too.
Okay. One for me. I'm writing that down right here. Yeah.
Well done.
Because that's a beautiful little piece there. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that has been probably the most stitched project out of that book.
Is it?
And it was one that I loved creating too.
You spent a lot of time in that book with instruction. how to, mm-hmm. how not to, how to get through one spot. It looked like, according to what Mary was writing, how to get out of some tough spots or get yourself corrected. So that looks yes. like it's pretty handy, just instructional book in addition to the projects.
Yep, I aim to make it so that a beginner can come to this book and have a good chance at being able to make these things. Okay. And also I include left-handed instructions because I am left-handed and left-handed people want to stitch too.
Darn it.
It's funny how it really is difficult to translate sometimes, you know, visually from one hand to the other.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of right-handers will say to left-handers, all you need is a mirror or sit opposite me and do exactly the opposite of what I'm doing.
No,
well, that works okay for some things. But there are other stitches, such as bullion stitch. The thread twist makes a difference. And if you're doing it opposite to the right-hander, it's not going to work in the same way. And so it works for some things, but in others it just doesn't.
Yeah, no, that just do it opposite routine. No, not buying that.
No.
No, it doesn't work. So then that the fact that you're left-handed, so then your two books, Left-Handed and Right-Handed Companions, mm-hmm. those are what all just fairly much conventional embroidery, but showing
yes,
how to do it both ways.
Yes, so the left-handed one was the one that I wrote first because I could see that there was a need in the market for something like that. Because whenever I teach left-handed students, they just love having a left-handed teacher. So I wanted them to be able to take a left-handed teacher home with them in the form of a book. So the book's got about 170 different embroidery stitches in it. Some of them are counted. Some of them are just surface embroidery. And it explains how to do them step by step with lots of diagrams. And then for each stitch, there's also one diagram that shows it right-handed. And I put that in there because sometimes it might be, say, a right-handed grandmother stitching with a left-handed granddaughter. And if the right-handed grandmother can see the difference of what she's doing to what her granddaughter's supposed to be doing, it can help her granddaughter.
'Cause that, you're the only one that's done that I've seen. Are there other left-handed books, or are you pretty much the only one that's done something like that?
There are a couple around, and they're probably 20 to 30 years old, so I thought that there could be space in the market for a new one, which was a bit more comprehensive.
That's a neat idea. I think I'm going to have to – now I got to buy more books. Oh, jeez.
Tragic.
Yes.
Well, I wasn't actually planning to write the right-handed one either, because I thought all stitch dictionaries are right-handed. They don't need another one. And then the right-hander said to me, "Yes, but we want yours." And I thought, "Oh, okay then. If you're asking for it, I'll do it." So yeah, I'm really pleased that I did, because it has been a great selling book and people do love it. So that's really nice.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Good for you, left-handers. Now give us a book. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So Elegant Hardinger was the first one. What was your second book?
So the next one was Mount Melick Embroidery, Inspired by Nature. And I wrote that one with my twin sister, Prue. And I asked her to do it with me because she's a botanical artist. And so Mount Melick Embroidery is a floral embroidery based on the flowers mm-hmm. and the plants that grow around the town of Mount Melick in Ireland. And so I thought, well, if she's doing it with me, then we'll have things look botanically correct.
Oh, okay.
And she is a stitcher too, so yeah. We probably won't write another book together again. In actual fact, our husbands have forbidden us to, because it wasn't a very happy experience.
Oops.
Yeah. We're better as sisters than we are as co-authors.
Uh-huh. There we have it. Now, is that, Mount Melick, is that another one of those that isolation played a role?
No, probably not, because Ireland's fairly well connected. Yeah, I don't know why that sprung up and stayed so geographically, disparate from other places. But then I suppose that's happened all around the world. I particularly noticed that in Portugal when I was there, that there are so many different styles. Each little town and region seem to have their own little style. So I guess that just happens the world over.
Yeah.
Maybe it's to do with belonging.
Yeah.
If you come
I think
from
so.
A,
thinking that, right.
Yeah, particular place, and this is what your town does, then that's what you do too, because it makes you part of that.
Mm-hmm. So Mount Melick, that's all white work too, right? Correct?
It is white work, and that one's not counted. That's surface embroidery. So that was a big departure for me, because most of the work that I'd done before that was counted embroidery. So I really had to move my brain into a different space to do that. But I loved doing it.
So your sister stitched projects in the book, or are they all your designs?
No, they're her designs, based on traditional designs. And we both stitched some of them.
Oh, okay. Okay. When you were getting along.
Well, we didn't have to get along when we were stitching, because we were each in our own houses doing that.
Oh, boy. Let's move on. Let's get away from that one.
Sure.
Okay, so what was the next one then?
The next one was Ukrainian drawn thread embroidery.
Did you travel to the Ukraine?
I didn't for that one. I actually went to the Ukrainian Museum in New York for that. They have a fantastic collection there. And it was particularly the embroidery from Poltava that I wanted to see, which is quite distinct, from the styles in surrounding areas. So I spent some time there with one of the curators and learnt heaps, saw many, many historical examples, and that was just fantastic. We preferred to go to New York and America rather than Ukraine because, well, I don't speak Ukrainian. I don't speak American either, but we have some fairly good connections with our English and your English, so that was good. And also, my husband had always wanted to go to America, so, yeah.
Okay, we'll go to America if I can study.
Yep. We've had lots of wonderful family holidays from my books because generally when we travel, the whole family comes too. And so our daughters get to see different parts of the world that they wouldn't have gotten to see otherwise.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's terrific. So then Ukrainian drawn thread, how is that different from, I guess, more conventional drawn thread things that we do? Is that unique in some ways?
Yeah, it's unique in the fact that a lot of drawn thread work, you would be withdrawing threads in both directions. With that style, you're only withdrawing it in one direction, meaning that it would be all threads withdrawn either across the warp or all across the weft, whereas in Hardanger, we'd be taking them from the warp and the weft. And also the way that they then weave their threads back in again is quite unique. So it uses a couching stitch, rather like Romanian couching, to put the threads back together again. And it creates an effect that rather looks like filet lace, but it's not. That's as clear as mud, I can tell.
No. Well, I'm trying to picture it, but what's really hitting me is just in this little bit we've talked, what a range of different types of stitching there is, and it's all done with white thread. I mean, we haven't mentioned one color yet.
Right.
No, we haven't. That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was so glad you were willing to talk to us, because it just so then that was the Ukrainian. That so that's that town, that Mereshka?
No, Mereshka is a term that means drawn thread work.
Oh, okay.
Poltava is the town that it comes from.
Okay, so that particular style from that town area.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Now, and this might be an unfair question, but are there variations of that throughout the Ukraine? Or
There are many different types of Mereshka throughout Ukraine. There are many different types of embroidery as well. They do a lot of cross-stitch there with traditional designs. They also do a lot of work with satin stitch. There's some pattern darning as well. There is a huge range of embroidery in Ukraine. Very rich cultural heritage.
So having traveled to all these different places and seeing all the different forms that embroidery takes in these places, how much of it, how much of the differences do you think are driven by the function of the piece or the original function that the piece was intended to have? And how much of it do you think is driven by the availability of materials when the style was being developed?
That's a really difficult question. A lot of the embroidery that I have worked with, apart from, say, Mount Melek, was originally done on clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So the women wanted to make their blouses beautiful. So the fabric would have been generally home woven linen, and
right.
the thread may have also been home spun. In Norway they used linen because linen grew well. In Mount Melek they used cotton because Mount Melek was known as the Manchester of Ireland. So Manchester was a huge cotton growing and milling town. Well, Mount Melek was the Irish version of that. So I think a lot of the time it has to do with what grows in the area and then
right.
how they can use those things to make their own unique style of dress to wear.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think of it in the sense that the materials available then drove the style in the sense of the aesthetic of it, right? Because there's
That's right.
certain things that you could do with silk that you wouldn't do with linen and vice versa. So it's sort of an interesting sort of mental exercise to think about if silk was available instead of linen, what those blouses would have looked like and how the style of dress would have been different and how then the style of embroidery would have evolved in a different way.
That's right. And when, so Mount Melek embroidery dates from around the 1800s, and it was sort of rediscovered, if you like, in the 1970s by a lovely old lady called Sister Teresa Margaret McCarthy, who was one of the nuns in the convent in Mount Melek. And she had heard about this embroidery and she asked people to bring pieces of it to her so she could see what it was like. They had an old trunk that was donated to the convent, and inside the trunk there were all these line drawings which were Mount Melek patterns. And so she asked them to bring their examples so that she could see what it was like and start to recreate some of these. But in the meantime, she started working on some of them and she used colours because she hadn't assumed that it would
that
be
it would
white
be
on
white.
White because everyone did stuff in colour in the 1970s. So that's what she did too. And then when they brought the pieces to her, she discovered, no, it was always white on white. It used matte thread on satin fabric. And so, yes, I think without knowing those things, it would have been very different if she had continued on with her colour. And I don't know if it was cotton or wool that she was using, but, yeah, it could have turned out to be totally different.
It's an interesting way to think about it. Because it really, every style is, it evolves from, you know, from something to something else. And it's interesting to think about what it is that drove that evolution in a particular way. And I think we don't, this is interesting because when we think about the types of embroidery that we do here, that's really just recreational. There's no driver of that evolution. Because it's just whatever happens to be the style at the time or the trend or the fad or whatever people feel like doing. There's no need for the item that someone is creating and there's no force that's being put upon it that is, well, this is what we have available because this is what grows in the region and this is what's economical for clothing use and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to see how need and scarcity quite frankly, drove perhaps more evolution into different types of styles of craft than pure recreation would have.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder whether in, say, 100 or 200 years down the track from today, whether they will be able to find any identifiable styles that grew up in this period.
Yes.
And I don't know whether they will be able to because everyone can do exactly what they like because they can generally get the threads that they want to do exactly what they want in whatever style they want. And they
Correct.
Can play around and do this and that. And, you know, we're all doing our own thing however we want to because we are so fortunate to have access to so many different things.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's only when you're forced into a position where you want to do something and you can't with what you have available that you have to invent something new.
Yeah.
So if you've always given the answer, you never have to come up with something new.
That's right.
Right? Or innovative. So
yeah.
Well, that's sad.
And that's not to say that no one's coming up with anything new or innovative though.
No, certainly not. And I think maybe now the driver now is not so much the need as it is it's technology, right? So there's, we were talking with somebody recently who was talking about different threads that have a stretch to them. And when you stretch them, the colors will change slightly and things like that. So then you start looking at things instead of looking at it as I need to make this particular item and I have these things. What's the best way? What's the most beautiful way I can do that? Now you say, you know, we were just talking yesterday and the conversation went in the exact opposite direction, which was I found this great new material and I have nothing to do with it. So, and I really want it. So what thing can I find that would use that material so that I can justify playing with it and using it? Mm-hmm. So it's the exact opposite direction.
Yeah. Coming at it from a totally different angle.
It is.
I think it's an interesting thought that what styles 100 years from now would come out of this time period. That's really a good thought because I'm not coming up with anything that would stand out.
No, I don't know that I am either, but maybe there's stuff going on around the world that I'm just not aware of. You know, I'm quite sure of that actually.
Cause I mean, there's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of trying. There's a lot of success, a lot of interesting designs and so on and so forth, but there's really nothing like that you can put in a box and say this is Hardanger.
Right.
Yeah,
there's no complete left turns, and I almost feel like the what's going to cause that sort of shift will have to be material driven, where we're given. So I guess the best analogy I can think of is the invention of the 3D printer. Because, and this is going to sound like kind of a kooky analogy, but, you know, before, if you wanted to make something, you had to, you know, carve it or, you know, imagine it, put it together, something like that. When a 3D printer was invented, you could basically create something on a computer, and draw it. And then this magical machine would just make a three-dimensional image of it. So that allowed us to then make all kinds of different things that we would never been able to make before because we didn't have those materials and we didn't have that means of construction. So I almost wonder if it's going to take that sort of technological change in order for us to do something. So maybe, and I'm thinking in like, I don't know, like in knitting, trying to think if there's another example, like the amigurumi knitting that is happening now. That's the only thing that I can think of that's something that's new, and it's not even that new, where really the only difference is that now you're knitting in three dimensions, which really is like a sweater, but you're doing it intentionally. But I can't think of another example where it's a real complete shift of how you use a technique to make something completely different. It is a very interesting question.
I think the other thing that could cause this sort of thing to happen is perhaps a real strong economic downturn.
Yes, I agree.
If people don't have the access to the things that, you know, we generally accept are available, then, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. They will start doing new things. Which may be reinterpreting old things, but that sort of situation could cause new things to come.
Right, and it's bringing back the original driver of the evolution and the divergence of all these styles, which was I have limited resources and I have a need for a particular thing. So how do I marry those two things together? So if we return to a state of need, then that will drive, you know, again, that force towards, you know, what can I do with this particular thread and that fabric? And I need to make this thing, right? It's that having that limitation seems to be what drives the creation of something new.
Yeah. Oh, what a fascinating conversation this is.
It's interesting to think about it that way, right? Because then you look at the books and all the different things that, that people have done in all these different areas of the world. And now you can kind of look at them and say, you know, so what was it going on? And I'm sure that you know some of these answers, maybe quite a few of them. What was going on, you know, socioeconomically or historically at the time that pushed it in that direction? You know, what made people make this type of art at that time?
Yeah, well, that was definitely something that happened with Mount Melick embroidery. So originally it was a lady in the town taught it to some of the women in the town. They came up with this style. I don't know if they came up with it together, but she taught them. And then it went into decline for a period. And then I think the 1840s, there was a woman called Mrs. Milner, and no one knows her first name. That's been lost to us. But she started an industrial association for women in the town to make some money. So this was the time of the potato famine, and people were destitute. And so they created the embroideries to sell in the Port of Cove so that people on their way, usually probably to America, would buy these things to take with them and therefore bring an income to the women of the town.
Yeah.
See, and I was gonna say, as you look through history, some of the best, most interesting art comes out of stress.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, whether potato famine or whatever it might be, someone has is mentally stressed, any number of things. That's where we see that time and again.
Yeah, well, I think that's how we get the most personal growth too, isn't it? Through times of trouble.
Yes. True. Yes. All right. We're going to run out of time, and I got to learn about Sardinian knotted embroidery.
Okay. So I'll stop you there. The next one was actually Portuguese white work. That was the next book. So we'll take a little detour into Portugal. I came across that one. I belonged to the New South Wales Embroiderers Guild, and I was down looking through books in their library one day, and there was a book on Portuguese embroidery, and there was this one page that had a photo of a blouse, and it had bullion embroidery and some drawn thread, well, some cut work on it, and I just looked at it and said, I have to know more about that. And I went home to my husband and said, how do you feel about a trip to Portugal? He said, oh, yeah, I think I can manage that. Can we go to France at the same time? So, yeah, I went to the town of Guimarães and met with so there were some ladies there who worked the embroidery in a workshop for sale in the town. And I also went to the local museum there and saw historical examples that they had in their collection too. And that's just another beautiful form of embroidery.
Now, when you do this and you go to a place like that and you see the museums and you meet the ladies, do you literally sit down with needle and thread and say, show me how?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I've already learnt the style beforehand, and I just go with my questions, things that I need solving. So it might be how to start or finish a thread, that sort of thing. And other times I just want to see as much as I possibly can, and therefore understand the style before I then start stitching. So Mount Melick, that was more of the way that I did it, because the stitches that they use in Mount Melick are usually common to other forms of embroidery. So there wasn't a lot that I needed to learn in forms of stitching, but there was a lot that I needed to learn in how the style was the style and what made it unique.
Oh, man, I want to follow you around. You must come home with a ton of pictures when you get done.
I do. I do. I have a really amazing photo collection of great embroidery.
Because, that's practically, as you're doing that research, that's the only way you can come home with things is photos. Yeah.
So I always have to request permission to be able to take photographs. And sometimes those photographs are only going to be able to be used for my personal research. And sometimes they will allow me to use them for publication as well. So it's a matter of negotiating that. But, I have a personal collection that's great.
All right. Next book is what?
It was the Sardinian book next.
Oh, okay, good.
We can move on to that one now.
Thank you so much.
I have a friend called Janine Robertson. She's in Canada. She writes a book on Italian needlework. on Italian. She writes a blog on Italian needlework, and look her up if you're at all interested.
So what's her name again?
It's Janine Robertson. She calls herself Janine in Canada, and she is amazing. She'll be so embarrassed that I said that. But she sent me an email many years ago with a picture of some now, the style of embroidery is called Punt A Nu. So that's what they call it in Sardinia. And she sent me a picture of this and said, are you interested in this, Yvette? And I looked at it and said, oh, yeah, that's interesting, and then moved on. And then quite a few years later, it was probably 5 or more years later, I was just looking for something to write my next book on, and I came across a picture of this embroidery and thought, that is beautiful. Janine will know about that. I'll write to her and ask her. So I wrote to Janine and said, do you know anything about this style of embroidery? And she said, Yvette, I told you about that years ago. And so I went searching back through my emails and found the email that she'd sent me and looked at it and thought, I understand why I wasn't interested at the time. The one that she'd sent me was worked in color on white fabric, and so therefore it didn't have the same whatever it is that jumps out at me about white work and says you need to know more, and so that's why I dismissed it. But seeing it in white on white, it was just quite different, and that's what really caught my eye. So she said, well, embarrassingly, I'm actually working on a book on that at the moment as well. So it was a little bit awkward, but she and her friends that she was writing their book with, they were just so generous, and we helped each other along the way, knowing that we would both write very different books and that there would be room in the market for both books.
Amazing how that comes together. So what is it about this style? Knotted?
Okay. So this was unlike anything that I'd ever done before. So it's a counted embroidery again, but it's worked on the surface of the fabric. And what you're doing is basically counting little coral knot stitches. So if you know coral knot stitch, it's basically the most simple knot that you can possibly do. But the thing about it is not how difficult it is to work the stitch, because that's not difficult. Putting it in the right place is the difficult thing. So you have to count the threads, and it's unique, particularly in the fact that when you turn it over, there's pretty much nothing on the back of the fabric. So it's all worked on the surface.
Oh. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, if you're making knots on the surface, yeah, you just got to pass through once to get to the next one, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So finishing threads, boy, you got to weave those through the... That's got to be a pain.
Yeah, it is. And that was... When I went there, that was my question. How do I finish threads and how do I start threads? So they were able to help me with that.
Yeah. So then, all I saw was the cover of that book. So what kinds of designs, and like Christine was talking about, what drove that kind of stitching?
That was also worked on shirts. Now, that wasn't on women's blouses. That was on men's shirts. And they have these big stand-up collars. I'm thinking in terms of centimeters. So about 12 centimeters, so that's probably about 5 inches high. So very tall collars, and it's embroidered on that collar. It's also on the cuffs, and it's at the top of the sleeves as well. So that was where that embroidery was used traditionally. It's very geometric in design. There are lots of different motifs such as crosses, there's hearts, there's some that are called cherries. They don't really look like cherries, but that's what they're called. There's almonds as well, and they've got this gorgeous little motif, which is a cockerel, a rooster, and it's really, really cute. The town of Teolada had a lot of Spanish influence, because Spanish settlers would have come across from Spain, and so the men's costume that they wear has a grey felt boatery sort of thing, and the white shirt, a black waistcoat, and they actually look very Spanish rather than Italian. But then Sardinians don't see themselves as Italian, they are Sardinian.
Yes. And don't think otherwise for a second.
Right.
That's right. Yes.
So you kind of answered this before, but one of my main questions is, what is it about white on white that appeals to you? Is that, I mean, everything you do is white on white. What is that about that?
Okay, let's just stop there. Not everything I do is white on white. Oh, okay. I do color as well. So if you look in my Stitch dictionaries, they are a riot of color, and I shocked people with that. But generally, white on white appeals to me because I just find it so elegant. And also, when you're not dealing with color, you can focus instead on the pattern and texture instead. And to me, that's just got immense appeal.
Okay. Yep. Well, there's an elegance. There's no doubt. There's a true elegance to all of that stuff. Yeah.
And you think about crisp white linen. Oh, that can't be beat, really, can it?
No, it can't. Yep. Exactly. Okay. All right. So next project is another book. And I know
you don't share much
till it's out, but.
Okay. So I'll let a little cat out of the bag here. It's counted. There you go.
Wow. Thanks so much for that insight.
It's another form of historical needlework, and I went to the place to research it, had a wonderful time, met some fantastic people who were so generous with their time and knowledge, and so I'm having a great time working on that book. But then I always have a great time working on my books. I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it.
Yeah. Now, Christine and I have talked many times in our other podcast about the supportive spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one
of them.
Yeah, you must have a really supportive spouse.
I do. And he knows far more about needlework than he ever expected to know.
Yeah.
When I write my books, he proofreads them for me because we figure if someone like him who really doesn't know anything about needlework can understand it, then hopefully anyone can. So I think that's a really valuable role that he plays for me. But, yes, he's so incredibly supportive. And, you know, he's actually – well, he's not my travel agent, but he's my travel planner. So when I say to him, like, I have considered Poland, I've considered Czechoslovakia. So, you know, I'd go to him and I'd say, well, how about Hungary? And he'd plan a whole trip around that. And I'd say, oh, actually, no, I think Poland. So then he'd plan that whole trip. So, yeah, he loves doing the travel parts and enjoys that part of it as well.
Well, he's got to be terrific, I'll tell you, because – well, I mean, of course, if he enjoys traveling, he's seen some parts of the world that probably very few have seen unless they live there.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And done some things that we never expected to. So when I was in Sardinia, I met up with a lady who had been introduced to me by my friend Janine. And so we met up with her one afternoon, and she took us to her friend's place, who was from a town called Desulo in Sardinia. I hope I've said that right. I don't really know. And she brought out all of the clothing, the traditional clothing that had been her daughter's as they had grown up. And she dressed up my girls in those beautiful, beautiful pieces of clothing. One of my daughters loved the experience. She just loved dressing up so beautifully. And the other one tolerated it. But I remember that day with such great fondness because that was an experience that I would never have had if I hadn't been introduced to her because of needlework.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, and your daughters, whether they enjoyed it or not, that's an experience
none of their friends have had.
No. in the game of one-upmanship here, nobody tops that. So, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh. That's fun stuff. All right, we gotta get wrapped up here. So two recommendations, and this first one, Color a Natural History of the Palette. I followed the link to that at Amazon. Oh man, I'm intrigued. So tell about that book.
Okay, so this was recommended to me by a friend who had loved it, and then my husband gave it to me for I think Christmas, and he's read it, and I'm just part of the way through it, and it tells. So each chapter is on a different color. I've read ochre, and I'm partway through black and brown, and then we'll move on to white, and there's yellow and red and green and indigo. And it's all about the pigments, where they've come from, the people, the stories that go along with the history of those colors and how they were used and found and the cultures that use them, and it's just wonderful. So here I am loving white work and enjoying a book about color.
That's neat. Yeah, that is neat. What a cool structure for a book, too, as well, doing it that way.
Yeah. So I still haven't read very much of it, but I'm just itching to get into more of it. Well, but what I've read, highly recommended.
Just the description alone, yeah, I gotta read that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's called Colour, A Natural History of the Palette, and it's by Victoria Finlay.
Yes. Okay, and we always have links to these things on the page for the podcast so people mm-hmm. can get them. And then the other one you've already talked about, but talk about more, is the
Sure. My other recommendation is that if you ever get the chance to go to Norway and you're in the Hardanger region, go to the Hardanger Folk Museum in Utna. And there they have the most fabulous collection of Hardanger embroidery, but also the regional costumes from the area. And when you see Hardanger, the traditional stuff, you will mm-hmm. see how different it is from what we know as Hardanger. So I have a friend that went to Norway last year, so I'd already been there, but she came back and she said to me, Yvette, now I understand. It is so fine. It's so different. And that is what I've been trying to communicate to people. And for her to have gone there and found that for herself, I thought, yes, this is really something that's worthwhile communicating. So if anyone ever gets the chance to go there, I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Okay. I got it. Yeah, that part of the world, we have neighbors who are hikers. And mm-hmm. Last year they went to Norway and came back, and the pictures, that country's amazing. That whole landscape
it's
is amazing.
Beautiful. Yeah. So I've been to the Hardanger Fjord in both winter and in summer, and the difference is incredible, and they were both beautiful.
For somebody who's always lived in the Midwest in the cornfields, anything with a decent bump, I'm fascinated by it. So
they've got big bumps there.
Yeah, they do. They do. Yvette, this has been just terrific. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. It's a great way to spend my morning, which is not morning for you.
Right.
No, thank you so much. This has been really a pleasure.
Yep. And all of Yvette's books available through the normal sources, Amazon and several places here in the States, and then get them from you in Australia. And
yes, they certainly can. Any good needlework book should have them, and if they don't, ask them to get them in for you.
Yep. Yvette, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it. Fiber Talk with Yvette, and we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.